For a number of weeks, we have been looking at the Gospel of Mark. Been looking at the Gospel of Luke. Yes. And this week, we're going to start again on another series, taking the next step along the journey through the Gospel of Luke. Good. I prepared the right sermon after all. So, to start with just a little bit of a recap as to where we had got to. Luke was written, we think, by a man called Luke. He was probably a companion of the Apostle Paul, and he wrote two books in the Bible, Luke's Gospel and then the book of Acts. The book of Luke is written to his friend Theo, as I call him for short, Theophilus. Luke and Theophilus were probably not Jews. They were probably Greek speakers, Gentiles. And Luke says he's writing to Theo for a very particular reason. He's not just writing a random biography. Here's some things about Jesus. That's not what it is. Not a random book at all. He's writing with a purpose, and the purpose is that Theo can be absolutely sure about the things he has been taught. Absolutely sure. No doubt about it. You can be sure of what you have been taught. Luke goes and does his homework, he says. He talks to eyewitnesses. I don't know, maybe he went and talked to Jairus' daughter, for all I know. He probably went to Capernaum just to check out, was the story true? He makes sure that what he's saying is reliable so that Theo can rely on it. The first section he writes, chapters 1 to 3, as we have it in our Bible, in these he shows how wonderful Jesus' birth was. Jesus is not just an ordinary man who happened to be born about 2,000 years ago in a place called Nazareth. No, that's not. He says, this is a remarkable story. He tells about the angels. There are angels all through. Angels appear to Zechariah. Angels appear to Mary. Angels appear to Joseph. Angels appear to the shepherds. That doesn't happen every day. Did any angels appear to anybody before you were born, Reuben, as far as you know? Probably not. Maybe I should ask you. No, probably not. No, this was a very special birth. It wasn't just a very special birth. There was also a very special man who we call John the Baptist. Baptist wasn't his surname. It's just a title we give him. This man called John, and there's an angel again involved in that. And John has been sent to prepare the way for the Messiah, a very special person. And John is doing this. It's not something that somebody dreamt up. This was written about hundreds of years beforehand. So we see that Jesus, in his birth, is a very special person. And Luke wants Theo to be absolutely clear about this. Jesus is a very special man. And in fact, the entire book that Luke writes is about Jesus. If you take out of Luke every sentence and paragraph that's not about Jesus, do you know what you're left with? Absolutely zilch, zero, luto, nothing. The gospel is about Jesus. And that's the first point I want us to get absolutely clear in our minds. The good news is only good news because of Jesus. Got that? Because in the world we're in, people say, well, it's religion, it's philosophy, it's ideas, it's nice being nice people, it's all that. No, it's not. That's all rubbish. Actually, the good news is about Jesus. If you take Jesus out, you are left with an empty box. Nothing in it. So Luke tells us that, and he wants us to get hold of that. And at the end of the third chapter, this man called John, he's going around baptizing lots of people all over the place. People are coming to him, And one day, Jesus comes, and Jesus is baptized by John. Now, here's something that doesn't happen every day. After Jesus is baptized, there's a voice from heaven says, "You are my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." And that really sums up the first three chapters. This is Jesus, God's Son. The next section we looked at, chapters 4 into halfway through chapter 9, Luke talks about Jesus' authority. Jesus is not just an ordinary man. Jesus has authority. And we see that very clearly in his teaching. People are amazed. They've had lots of rabbis, lots of teachers. No offense to teachers. There's never been a teacher like this before. He teaches with authority. He doesn't refer to somebody else, which was the normal practice. Sorry, have I upset something, Mark? It's a normal practice. He spoke on his own authority. He didn't refer to anybody else. But his authority wasn't just in what he said. His authority was in what he did. And we get in those five chapters a flood of extraordinary things that Jesus did. We call them miracles. Things that you can't account for by the normal laws of what we would call nature. 12 incidents of things. Blind people see, deaf people hear, crippled people walk, dead people live, storms are calmed, and thousands of people eat what was meant to be just a lunch. Jesus does these things to demonstrate his authority. And when he raises somebody from the dead, he doesn't pray to God, to his Father, asking him to raise the person from the dead. No, Jesus just does it. He does it in his own authority. And again, at the end of that section, Jesus is what we call the transfiguration. Jesus goes up a mountain, there's Jesus, and there's a couple of others as well. And Peter's rather interested in the couple of others, but Jesus is left on his own. And a voice from heaven again says, "This is my Son, my chosen one. Listen to him." So have we got it? Jesus is a very special person. He is the person that the good news is all about. Secondly, Jesus is a man of authority. When he speaks with authority. And when he acts, he does the most amazing things with total authority. And all of this is given its sort of imprimatur, its credentials by a voice from heaven saying, "This is my Son." Have you got it so far? Things are going well in Luke's gospel. People are following. People like it. People like the miracles. Is there somebody hiding behind that pillar? People like the miracles. And the crowds go along. Yeah, there's a bit of opposition. The religious leaders aren't too sure about him. But when we get to chapter 9, the tone changes. There's been a blue sky, but now there are some dark clouds coming rolling in. There was a nice sort of warm, balmy breeze before, but now there's a chill in the breeze. The music goes from being in the major key to being in a minor key. Things are changing when we get through to the middle of chapter 9. And we're going to see over the next coming weeks, things change a lot. So we had three chapters about who Jesus is. We had five chapters about his authority. That only gets us up to chapter 9. There are 24 chapters. I think I'm right in looking, if my arithmetic is okay. There are 15 chapters where things aren't looking so good. The first three chapters deal with about 30 years of Jesus' life. The next five chapters deal with something like 3 years of Jesus' life. The last 15 chapters deal with somewhere probably between the last 3 weeks and the last 3 months of Jesus' life. So we're heading into, it's not a big chunk in terms of time, but it's a big chunk of the things Luke says he needs to make sure Theo is sure about. This is important where we're heading. It's not just another bit of the story. How do we know things have changed? Well, in chapter 9, there are two very, very clear indications. First one is Peter, heard about him. Peter reaches the conclusion that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah, the promised one. We're told that. Now, that's a big discovery for Peter. And what are we told in the next verse? Do you remember? Let me tell you. We're told in the next verse, Jesus says, I'm going to be killed. Do you see the change? Peter says, you're the Messiah, and we've been building up to that in Luke's account. All about who Jesus is. And at last, you might say, Peter gets it. And just as Peter gets it, rather than going off and having a party and celebrating that Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus turns around and says, I'm going to be killed. Second one, you remember the story about the transfiguration? Jesus goes up to the mountain and this voice from heaven says about, you're my son. What's the next thing recorded? Next thing recorded is Jesus says, I'm going to be killed. Now, you have to be pretty thick not to see the change in the message. We're turning into something, the tone is quite different. From Jesus the great miracle worker drawing the crowds, we're now turning into something that starts to be much darker, much more difficult. In the remainder of Luke, there are only four miracles. 15 chapters, Jesus only works four miracles. In the previous five chapters, he works 12 miracles. And it's summed up in an expression that Jesus says here about Jesus. It says, he turned his face towards Jerusalem. Now, let's read the passage in Luke chapter 9. All you eager beavers, get your phones out or your Bibles out. Luke chapter 9, we're going to read from verse 51, I hope. Okay, reading from verse 51, I all got it. When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem. We probably know what Jerusalem stands for here. We'll find out in a minute. Next verse, please. And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans to make preparation for him. But the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw it, they said, Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them? But he turned and rebuked them. And they went on to another village. Okay, we'll just stop there. So here's Jesus, and he's making his way through Samaria, a Samaritan village. Brackets, you remember what the Jews and the Samaritans thought of each other? They couldn't stand each other. So Jesus is walking through Samaria, which is a bit off anyway. And as he's going, he sends people off to arrange dinner, bed, and breakfast for 13, please. In this village, and the village says, no, we won't have anything to do with them. And he passes on, he goes to another village. James and John, they are disgusted by this. They are thinking, oh man, what a village. We are going to destroy them. We're going to zap them. They're going to knock them out completely. And Jesus says, no. He just passes on. I want us to see that as the first warning. The warning is that if we reject Jesus, you might not get zapped. Life might just go on as normal for you. And you might think or hear no more of it. But Jesus has passed by. So think of that now. Your life might not end up being absolutely dreadful because you reject Jesus. But you might miss that opportunity to get to know him. Let's continue reading. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, I'll follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. So this man comes up and says, I want to follow you. There's lots of crowds there, people following Jesus. Said, I want to follow. And Jesus just points out a bit of reality here. You're following somebody who, by the way, doesn't have a home. I love my home. I really like it. I like to get back to my house, my bed, everything the way that I like it. Jesus said he didn't have that. He had no home. That's the person that this man wanted to follow. And Jesus just saying, look, you realize what you're doing here, who you're following. Jesus said, oh, carry on the next verse. To another, he said, follow me. But this man said, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. Now, that isn't saying that his father had died 2 or 3 days before and he wanted to go to the funeral. No, if the father had died, he would have been buried that day or the next day. No, what this man is saying is, my father's still alive, but I really should look after my family responsibilities before I follow you. He's saying, no, let me look after my family responsibility and then follow you. Now, Jesus didn't say to him, look, your family doesn't matter. You don't worry about your father and mother. No, God says, honor your father and mother. But what Jesus is saying is, follow me first and then honor your father and mother, whatever that may mean for you and whatever the circumstances. Honor me first, then look after your family responsibility. Carry on. Next verse. Yet another said, I'll follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home. Nothing wrong with saying farewell to your friends and family and doing all that. But you see the order again. First, I'm going to sort out my family relationships and my community and say goodbye and have a few hugs and kisses or whatever they did. I'll do that first, and then I'm going to follow you. And Jesus said, no, that's not the way it works. You follow me first, and then you work out your community relationships and responsibilities. Jesus said to him, no one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. Now, that's scary. No one who puts his hand to the plow, nobody who starts off and then turns around is fit for the kingdom. Nobody who starts off and turns around is fit for the kingdom. As I was reading these verses and thinking about them, I thought about three people I know. And to me, in different ways, they represent what this story is about. And so I thought I'd tell you about my three friends. So please indulge me while I tell you a story or two. The first one I met at school. His name is Clive. Clive was athletic. Clive was musical. He was a good folk singer. Clive had a spectacularly wonderful girlfriend. And Clive was also academically very, very bright. And we all envied Clive, to be honest. We were a bit jealous of Clive, especially the girlfriend, but Helen, I can still remember her clearly. Clive had it all. And Clive was also a lovely person and a very strong Christian. So, I mean, that's really galling, isn't it? This person who has it all and he's really nice. Whoa, sickening. Anyway, Clive was very bright. He got a scholarship to go to Imperial College London, which is up there with Oxford and Cambridge, in case you're not familiar with universities. He went to first term in London, came back home and was involved in a dreadful car accident. Clive spent, I can't remember exactly, but months in a coma. I think probably at least 3 months in a coma. He spent something like 3 years in hospital as surgeons, therapists, and various people tried to put Clive back together again. After about 3 years, Clive emerged from hospital. Now, he could walk, but he couldn't walk very well because his left leg, the accident had hit him on the left side, his left leg was still damaged, so he walked with a bad limp. So the medium distance runner that he had been, that's gone. The rugby player, that's gone. He could use his left arm a little bit, but not very much. It was also very badly damaged. But worst of all, he suffered a great deal of brain damage. His memory was completely shot. Gradually, he learned things and memory. He had to learn his name again. He had to learn his friends' names. He had to learn where he lived. It had all been wiped out. He had to relearn all of that in his memory. But he recovered a little bit. His mind was a bit like a beautiful glass vase that gets broken into pieces. All the bits are there, but they're not joined together anymore. Anyway, Clive emerges out of hospital and into a new life. He got a job in a bank as a messenger boy. Now, here's somebody who had a brain the size of half a planet, and he's a messenger boy. He's taking mail from the mail room up to offices and doing that. He lives in a small house. He drives a small car adapted for the disabled, and he has a pretty non-existent social life. And Clive goes on. I see him years afterwards in church. There is Clive. He's sitting on the right-hand side of the church, about a third of the way up to the front, and he's calm. He's at peace. I knew Clive quite well. One day after lunch at our house, I said, Clive, look, all of this has happened to you. You've had all of this stripped away. Everything except basically being able to eat and breathe. It's all been stripped. Clive, why are you not angry? Why are you not upset at God for what he has done to you? And Clive, I remember his reply very clearly. Clive said, you know, when I was a young teenager, he said, I decided, can you stand up, please? I have decided, turn around, please. No going back. Clive said, when he was, thanks very much for being my illustration. Clive had said that when he was a young teacher, he had decided to follow Jesus. And in his clear thinking, that was it. He said he committed his life to Jesus. He said Jesus was in charge. So all the things that he had were a gift from God, and God took them away. So what has changed? He said, nothing's changed. I decided to follow, and I am not going to turn back because of what has happened to me. Now, that's 52 years ago we had the accident, and Clive is still calm and patient and gentle and still following Jesus. In fact, he said that one of the worst things, no, he didn't say it was one of the worst things, he said the worst thing of all about his accident was his vocal cords were damaged in the accident, and he could no longer sing. He said, I can't sing praise to God. I could understand him being angry and shouting at God. He actually said, I can't sing praise because my throat's damaged. He said that was the worst thing about what had happened to him. You see, Jesus says that life might be tough. No, Jesus doesn't say life might be tough. Let's be honest. Jesus never promises you're going to be healthy for all of your life. Did you know that? Jesus never promises that you're going to be prosperous. See, all you young people looking for jobs, there is no guarantee you're going to be prosperous. Jesus says, however, I can guarantee it's going to be difficult. And the question is, are you deciding as long as the sun's shining and all's going well? Is that your decision? Are you deciding, no, I'm going to follow Jesus no matter what? The second person I met at university, his name is John. John was this massive person. He was about 6'4" and 110 kgs. A very impressive person, a very keen, strong Christian, and good sportsman, all the works. You can see how jealous I was when I was a young man. And by the way, he's not bald now either. I'm not so jealous about that. John did very well, got a good degree, and went to work for one of the biggest law firms in London. And he worked there, he worked hard, he did very well, he got on well. When he was in his late 20s, they offered him a partnership in the firm. Now that's serious. It's serious prestige, serious sort of reputation, and very serious money. I mean, that's the big house, the fancy car, the children at private school, the works if you're a partner in that firm. But John said, thank you very much, but the Lord wants me to go and be a Bible teacher and a pastor. So he went off, he said, thank you very much. He was very nice about it. And he went off, he spent 2 years at Bible college learning some stuff. And then he spent 2 years as an intern in a church, unpaid intern as a church. And after 4 years preparation, he got a job as assistant pastor in a large church in London. Actually, just down the road from where his office had been. The job he got in the church paid 5% of what he had been offered as a lawyer. He took a 95% cut in salary to do what the Lord wanted him to do. Now, he never got the big house. He never got the fancy car. His three kids didn't go to the best private schools. But he knew that's what the Lord was calling him to do. I had a conversation with him a few years after he'd started in the church. And again, it was the same question, you know, look what you've given up. How do you do that? And John looked at me. He was actually quite puzzled. He couldn't really understand the question. It didn't make any sense to him that you would ask a question like that. Because he said, you can't compare what he had given up to what he had gained. And I was reminded of what Paul has to say. Paul has to say that the things he gave up, his reputation, his nationality, his luxury, his job, he said all of that is like the stuff you put in a black plastic bag and put out at the gate to be taken away by the waste disposal people, the bin men, or whatever you call them. He said, that's what all of that is like compared with what I have in Jesus. And that's a very different way of looking at the world. And that's what John said. He said, what I've given up, the big car, the big house, the fancy car, the private education, the holidays, and I don't know where. He said, that doesn't even begin to compare with what he had gained by doing what Jesus wanted him to do. So it's not easy. I've never taken a 95% cut in my salary. I don't know anyone offering to do that here today.
Yeah, I do.
I didn't think so somehow. So that was John. You see, he decided to follow Jesus. It required a difficult decision, but he'd made that decision. The decision was he's following Jesus. Not about salary, houses, cars, etc. It's about following Jesus. And he had no regrets. He didn't even understand the idea that he might possibly regret it, the things he missed. The third person I want to talk about is a guy called Feroz. Feroz lived in our granny. He and his wife, lived in a granny flat in our house in Belfast. Feroz was from Iran. Iran is an aggressively Islamic country. Feroz grew up in a devout Muslim household, a Muslim community, a Muslim school. Everything was Muslim. In fact, Feroz said he'd never seen or been in a Christian church. He'd never seen a Bible. And as far as he knew, he had one friend who might be a Christian. One night, Feroz goes to bed, sleeps, and has a dream. Now, dreams are considered much more important in a Middle Eastern culture than in our materialistic Western culture. So he goes to has this dream, and in the dream he sees Jesus. Don't ask me how he knew it was Jesus, but he knew. And Jesus says to him, follow me. Just like that. Feroz is worried, disturbed by this. Next night he goes to bed, he has the same dream. Jesus says to him, follow me. So what does Feroz do? He does. He decided there and then that's what he's going to do. He tells his family. His family throw him out, disown him. In all the years afterwards, he never met or spoke to his father ever again. He spoke to his mother a couple of times on the phone many years later. But he was totally disowned by his family. There was a price put on his head that anybody who killed Feroz would get a reward. So he had to flee the country. So here's a young man, and he gives up everything. And he flees, and he wanders through his way through Europe. He ends up in Belfast. But you see, Jesus had said to him, follow me, and Feroz did. Regardless of the consequences, he was 110% committed to that. Other things didn't matter. I was jealous of Feroz as well. Actually, he had a very beautiful wife, but that's another story. I was jealous of Feroz. You know what? Feroz didn't have a care in the world. Not a care in the world. Because Jesus had said to him, don't worry about what you eat. So Feroz didn't. Jesus said, don't worry about what you wear. So Feroz didn't worry about it. Jesus said, don't worry about where you live. So Feroz didn't. It was as simple as that. He had turned 100% towards Jesus, and it was Jesus' problem to sort those things out, not Feroz's problem. Now, he did work and he did whatever, but at the end of the day, he didn't worry about it. It was brought home to us very clearly on his last day he stayed with us. He had been called by an Iranian church, Persian church in America, in Georgia, Alabama. Is Alabama in Georgia, Marv? Yes, I think it is. Anyway, he was called to this church, so Feroz buys two tickets to Georgia and heads off. He packs up all his possessions, him and his wife. Now, this is all his possessions. When we came to South Africa, we brought all our possessions. We had a 40-foot container with a car and a grand piano in it. Well, Feroz heads off to the airport, and a friend said, well, the friend had to go and get a trailer to take the luggage. Feroz is setting off with a vast amount of luggage. Now, I mean, we were experts. We had flown a lot. We knew you, if it's 23 kgs, you might get away with 24, maybe 25, but you'd be really pushing it at 105 or whatever Feroz had. There was no way. Feroz didn't have a care in the world. He knew Jesus had called him to go to Alabama. End of story. He needed all this stuff. His books, his clothes, his photographs, whatever it was. He needed all that stuff. So over to you, Lord. Your problem. And we thought, yeah, right. We heard a bit later what transpired. Feroz turns up British Airways check-in desk at Belfast with this pile of mound of luggage. And the lady behind the desk says, that's going to cost an awful lot in excess baggage. Feroz said, I don't have any money. Which was absolutely true. He didn't have any money. And he said, oh, you can put it on your credit card. And Feroz said, I don't have a credit card. The woman looks puzzled. She goes off and speaks to her manager and comes back and says, I think we found a solution. He said, if you travel first class, there is no limit on the amount of luggage you can take. I didn't know that. So British Airways upgraded Feroz and his wife to first class. Now, that's a funny little story, but I tell it to illustrate. See, Feroz didn't care. He didn't. It wasn't his problem. How do you get that amount of luggage to Alabama? It wasn't his problem. That was God's problem. And I'm jealous of that. Because I don't think like that. I think it's my problem all too often. So there's three examples of people who faced some sort of difficulty, some sort of hardship, whatever you want to call it, quite significant, and how the three of them decided that they would follow Jesus. Also, remember, notice none of the three regretted it. None of the three regretted that they'd follow Jesus, even though they did have to pay a high price one way or another. So, where does that get us to? Gets us back to this passage. And the question is, what are we going to decide to do? I can tell you something that everybody in this room who hears these words is going to do before they go out the door. I am a mind reader. I can tell the future. I can tell you something. Every one of us is going to do before we go out there. We're all going to decide, are we going to follow Jesus? You might say, no, I'm really not there yet. I'm not sure that I can commit to that. Well, if you're not deciding to follow Jesus, you are actually deciding not to follow Jesus. That light is either on or it's off. If it's not switched on, then it's off. If you don't decide to follow Jesus, you are deciding not to follow Jesus. And every one of us is going to make that decision before we go out that door and have our coffee. It's serious. Now, for some of us, we've never made a decision to follow Jesus. There's always been some reason, there's been some priority. Your education, your sporting life, your social life, your marriage. There's always something that gets in the way and we don't make the decision. And I'm saying, remember that Samaritan village. You remember the one that said they didn't want Jesus and they weren't struck by lightning or anything. What happened? Jesus has walked on past. And you know, if you hear today about making a decision to follow Jesus, you might not hear it again. Jesus might just walk on past. This might be the day, the only chance you get to decide to follow Jesus. There's some of us here, and we have decided, hopefully, God willing, there's lots of us here. We have decided to follow Jesus. In some cases, it was a long time ago. Somebody asked me this morning, how long had I been a Christian? I had to admit 65 years. I'm a slow learner. Whether you've made that decision 3 months ago or 30 years ago, you're going to make a decision today. Your decision today is, are you going to go out today and follow Jesus? Not what did you do last month, last year, last century. What are you going to do today? Are you going to do what Jesus? There's that person you could go and talk to. Befriend them. Are you going to do it, or are you going to watch something on Netflix instead? There's a person who the Lord says to you, go and help that person, maybe in a practical way. And are you going to do it, or are you going to say, no, there's something else I have to do? Are you going to say that actually following Jesus, I need to know where he's going? I need to talk to him. I need to listen to him. And I'm going to do that. I'm going to read my Bible, not because I have to read my Bible, but I want to follow Jesus. And they say, you can't follow somebody if you don't communicate. So what are you going to do? Are you going to say, yes, today, tomorrow, and the next day, I am going to follow Jesus? And I say that to the old hands, if I can call us that. Because it's easy to think we've got it cracked. We're in a routine, we're in a pattern, and we're not going to go too far wrong. But actually, we can go just as far wrong as you younger people can. It's a decision today for each of us. Are we going to follow Jesus today? And that's what I want to leave you with, that question. Are you, whoever you are you going to decide before you go out that door, I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to do what he wants. Are you going to say that actually there's something more important in my life just at the minute? I don't know, looking at young people, it's my education, it's my career, it's my marriage, it's my friends, it's my social life. Are you going to do that today? Like, as in, now? Thank you.